Work design can and should support the ongoing growth of people to take more into account in their work and feel a strong sense of responsibility and personal agency towards greater orders of contribution. But any system, you know, any work system I've been in where people are seen as having a limited set of intelligences tends to predominantly be focused with external influence on behavior inside the organization, right? Rather than on development for the capacity to contribute externally to the organization. Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. You know, for this one, once in a while, we see new ideas about the future of work and how to design it. Holacracy, for example, is about changing work design without, unfortunately, all the underlying capabilities of workers to see and work systemically and how to build those. So most work designs come from a spectrum, starting with traditional and kind of moving towards arrest disorder paradigms, and are really aimed at making better places to work by doing things like getting rid of supervisors and the like. So it's rare to have articles or ideas on learning as a result of kind of where work design comes from, and more specifically, like where it comes from within the do-good paradigm. And so that's what we're actually doing today. So for those curious to learn more, actually, Carol's third book actually talks a lot about this, and it's called The Regenerative Business: Redesign Work, Cultivate Human Potential, and Achieve Extraordinary Outcomes. So prepare yourselves to question all your good deeds today once again, dear listeners. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, as you know by now, a contrarian one, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn how to work more closely with us or how to join a multi-organization business team or change agent community, stay tuned to the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout. And with me, as always, is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So work design, as we know, is core to your research and study, actually, because you believe it can do much more than make just great places to work. It's training people ultimately on how society could work. And you might actually also think of it as a training ground or conditioning for how democracy could work. So what's your take on the subject kind of overall, Carol, of work design?
Well, I'd probably say we're working on moving from training to development, but you're right. It's at the heart of my work. And in fact, I would say it is the next subject for the core of social responsibility, that is, democracy is. If we could change how we work on all of the subjects we have, like climate change, inequity, gender inequity, orientation, racial, all of those things, we would also be improving the ability of democracy to work. Currently, what we're doing is dumbing people down by how they work. And we've been doing that for 100 years, not smarting people up, as this article suggests. And I was recently just rereading Aldous Huxley, and one of the things he said was, generalized intelligence and mental alertness are the most powerful enemies of dictators. And at the same time, they offer the basic conditions for an effective democracy. So having said that, I believe the authors of this article have different purposes for building smart employees, and the means they use and so the ways they assess. So I'm seeing the headline that, you know, like it's a good one, but I believe we're doing it for different reasons and with less, let's call it moral ethics built in. So Zach, maybe to help, you're always good at giving us kind of the overview of what the authors are offering as a solution. And in this case, I'd love to hear that, what you think their purpose is.
Right. So the article we're looking at today is called How Well-Designed Work Can Make Us Smarter by Sharon K. Parker and Gwyneth G. Fisher from the Spring 2020 MIT Sloan Management Review. Because, you know, we felt like we should give HBR a break and maybe go after MIT for a little while. So in our article today, which as always, we encourage you all, by the way, to read and do your own thinking on as well. The authors actually propose that work design can make workers smarter depending on that design. And so the authors define work design as, quote, the nature of people's work, how well it's organized on a team or independently. And so in the author's view, good work design should be created using the four following methods, just so I can give you kind of a full overview here. One, develop and train managers who understand how to create high quality work using the SMART model, which is an acronym for stimulating, mastery, agency, relational, and tolerable. And then number two, organize work differently to improve workers' learning. Number three, develop work policies and culture that align with enriched work design. And then number four, promote individual efforts to improve the design of their own work. So, Carol, you want to present a little bit of an overview assessment maybe here?
Well, I mean, as I sit and listen to you do those again, I think that all this entire article, most of MIT, most of HBR, all have the same idea. You can hear it when they talk about the word manager and leader, which is work design and work itself comes from outside of the worker. So everything they have in this article is based on that existing construct about work. It's also only for the benefit of business. And as you already pointed out, I want us to talk a bit about the effect on the bigger world. Our purpose, therefore, is, or at least mine, is about the meaningful role in democracy that work design plays. And in the same way that we had supply systems which were contributing to the climate change, we have work design systems that are keeping us from solving the wicked problems, from building a society, and developing citizens that are up to the task. So they're all external, and we need to switch over from the idea of developing leadership to systems development, including human development. So, Zach, what is the means they offer? They give five aspects of work design and some kind of guidelines to go with it.
Sure. So they propose that there are five aspects, as Carol said, of work design that really influence cognition. And I also kind of want to give you, I think at least what we see is the paradigm them being sourced from. So number one, job autonomy, how much workers have say really over their work and decisions. And as far as we could tell, this aspect comes from the do-gooder humanist paradigm, which we see reflected quite a bit in a lot of the newer workings of design offerings, which really started to consider the worker over just the leaders and the machines in which they're working. Number two, feedback. So how much information a worker receives about the effectiveness of their work endeavors. So this aspect comes from the machine or industrial paradigm, as we've talked about at length on this podcast many times. Number three, job complexity, which is the extent to which a job puts mental demands on a worker. So this aspect, again, comes from the machine view, inherently actually limiting the consideration of work to tasks that can be completed above all else. And then number four, relational aspects of work, which is the social context around which work is executed. And so this aspect comes again from the do-good paradigm, which is where, you know, things that are happening around the worker start to become considered rather than just the performance of the worker. Number five, psychosocial demands. And so this really concerns workload, emotional demands, and psychological costs associated with that work. And again, coming from do-good, where the worker's internal state is also now considered, typically, unfortunately, at the level of sensitive energy.
Yeah, it makes me tired to listen to all that. just kind of what I noticed right at the top and when I was reading through this is, again, it's all inside the construct. What we need is some extraordinary other who somehow has become better than everyone else, who is responsible for what work gets done, but they'll give away some authority over you choosing when, timing, and so forth. But it's still not involved in how the work is structured, how the systems are structured. The whole idea of feedback still, it's always dumbing down people's ability to see themselves. They are increasingly dependent on other people's opinions, interpretations, and their trust gets transferred from themselves to the other. Complexity here is still externally determined, and when we come back and talk about, I do think complexity is important, but not as an end in itself. Creating something that's beyond what you know how to do is a better source of complexity in service of something rather than, well, how do we ratchet up their mental skills as they're here? And then, of course, the whole idea of support is pretty limited. It means we, the outside folks who know more, are supporting you, trying to make sure that we don't have the kind of demands and stress rather than maybe the good stress you create from becoming more creative is what we would suggest. So I know you look at this stuff a lot also, and I'm wondering how you experience when you think about yourself over the years having gotten smarter and how that happens and maybe up to modern times. You know, what does this link look like between smart and work design?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. And in my work, I get told all the time on like sales calls, for example, it's like, wow, you really know a lot about motion capture. You guys must be so smart. And it's like, I think you're missing the point. Maybe it's like smartness or how intelligent I am by conventional measurements actually has nothing to do with how much I know about an industry or its customers or how it works or all these kind and the core processes of it. It's like, this is coming from someone who's had to take his SAT 7 times to break 1100, who wasn't at the top of his class any year in school and who got rejected from every college I applied to except like 2. So becoming smarter, at least in my experience, is a developmental process, right? It's not just the core, it's not just work design. It's engaging in our work and this school that's helped me to become smarter, I guess you could say, in all aspects of my life. But that's made up of so many dimensions of who I am, not just two kinds of intelligence as the kind of the authors offer here. Work design can and should support the ongoing growth of people to take more into account in their work and feel a strong sense of responsibility and personal agency towards greater orders of contribution. But any system, you know, any work system I've been in where people are seen as having a limited set of intelligences tends to predominantly be focused with external influence on behavior inside the organization, right? Rather than on development for the capacity to contribute externally to the organization. So, Carol, why are we stuck, though, in the way that kind of most organizations and institutions view this?
I think it's partly it's just so familiar after 100 years of working this way or more. And we've come to live inside of three kind of images or models of work design. One, obviously, is the authoritarian command and control. And then, as you pointed out, we have an increasing amount of this humanist idea. Developmental, which is our world, we don't talk much about. There are only a handful of us trying to bring that about. The first two, which are the sources of these five aspects that you just laid out, are what holds us back in many ways. So we still assume, even when we do good, that we have to have a kinder, gentler form of command and control. All of these five, and they're even opening what you have to do to get people ready, are all still housed inside of command and control. That's all you can see. So it's now humanistic command and control. Doing something good with your command. The third one comes from a very different epistemology and set of beliefs. I call it moving away from the third party design model, where someone else is in charge, someone else evaluates, to developmental self-determining, where I get to be growing myself, committing to things, and developing a way to see the world with everyone that's very different. I'm sure you've struggled with all of this and switching paradigms and epistemology yourself, because you grew up in the Western psychology view. How do you work on yourself?
Yeah, I mean, first off, it's hard, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think we've ever said that any of this is easy. But one point the authors make, which I will agree to, is around tacit knowledge. That stuff is really hard to change. And most of the business practices we see are sourced from kind of the two lower paradigms that Carol mentioned. But it takes only a moment to find the space between how I was taught to automatically approach work and then instead introducing a framework, let's say.
Yeah.
I don't do it all the time. I'm not perfect, but that's what development is about, right? It's about this unfolding process of growth.
Yeah.
And so, Carol, if you can you speak to some principles of work design to kind of send intelligence out of this room for a bit again?
Yeah. Today, just responding, reacting to what this article's about, I saw six, and they're not all that we have, but they're core ones to really creating work design. And in each case, after I share a bit, would you talk about how it relates to what goes on inside a super alloy, or at least sure. in your mind, all right?
Yeah, for sure.
So the first one is that every person in each team is linked not to internal competencies and measures, but to external world where customers, consumers live, and with the intention of promoting deep understanding of their lives. And the external considering, not that old internal, it's all about us and me. Not, you know, stopping using delegation and surveys. So you begin to use market indices that are based on the buyer's actions and what their life is like. If you're constantly saying, how does what I do right here in my work affect the life of people who are going to have the product or service we offer, it'll wake on something that's been put to sleep, which again, we call external considering. It's a mechanism that's necessary to be developed to become self-determining, the ability to see myself so that I can guide myself and therefore autonomously be self-directing. We don't need supervisors and feedback because this is reawakened. So you get smarter because you push every day not to serve or not to comply with what you're being asked to measure by, and not to just demonstrate your competency by somebody else's arbitrary and abstract standard, but by what you can see, what you can feel, what's going on in the work, by the real lives that you are helping raise up and bring creation and responsibility for their lives. So how might that work at Super Alloy?
Sure. So we actually just took our first crack at this actually this week through a kind of consideration and reflection on buyer nodes, which is a process that we are quite familiar with in the school. And so buyer nodes doesn't start from demographics or customer surveys, but it's instead reflecting on actual real customers to begin to see patterns at work. And our team found this actually incredibly helpful to be able to be more discerning about what customers we take on and why.
And they get excited, don't they? I
mean, exactly. Yeah.
Amazing. It's like when you think about why you fall in love, when you actually think about what the love of your life would be, make them happy, suddenly there's a whole different spirit. Okay. So taking that old story, let's go to the second principle I would offer, or maybe they're more concept. Keeping everything tied, not to a list of goals or competencies or internal measures, but to something that we call strategic corporate direction. And the reason you want to be tied to that is it embodies the essence of your company, of Super Alloy, but it also has in it, in the statement that you write, a connection to global imperatives, the kind of things we talked about, like climate health and fairness and equity in how we do business. It includes external performance indices for your buyers, so you don't have externalities you don't know how to measure. So if you understand all that, you can allow each person to have a lot more autonomy and connection and agency, because that's their anchor. So like, it's much better than a North Star. Every time I hear people say North Star, they usually mean North Star, the business itself, not of what's creating in the world. If people can look up and see that in their mind, this corporate direction, they have an ability to evoke their own personal essence expression, but they have a clear boundary. They know what the meaning is, the ethics, what's been vetted, what how to work developmentally. And it immediately and over time makes people smarter because they're connecting with their impact, their effect on greater wholes and their role in it. So how about super alloy?
Yes, I mean, I think it's still useful to kind of stick with buyer nodes for a second, actually, because I think this relates. And it's interesting to see how the buyers you engage with are really a reflection of the strategic direction of the company and its essence. And I think that was one thing we were all struck by. And in our work this past week, we actually saw really clearly how our customers reflecting these different aspects of us. And when they weren't, oh man, that was some of our most brutal gigs that we had. So it was really powerful to be able to see that.
I do believe you're talking about this essence to essence attraction,
mm-hmm.
where once you're clear about your corporate direction, which embodies your essence, and your workers are drawn there for the same reason, it's not a big step to understand how your customers come to you for the same reason. So now everyone's kind of aligned. Let's look at the third concept. We have something in the story that these authors gave us about what you do with managers, leaders. We suggest that instead of doing something with them, you convert them to mentally thinking of themselves as resources, not as leaders of delegators, all that stuff that goes with that. We're resources to the self-determined developmental capability of everyone in their group. And in the companies we do this in, their groups tend to be self-forming around these buyer nodes you're talking about. And they're deciding where it is the company can go within that context of the strategic direction. And now you have a team of resources, some that are knowledge and skill-based, others that are thinking and development-based. And what you do is you watch the switch that goes from I'm in charge to I am a resource to their capability, and you watch them get smarter because they're using a new kind of intelligence. We call them structural intelligence, where you can see through frameworks and make sense out of how people are thinking and help them do that. And associative intelligence, where they have knowledge in the world that needs to be brought about how things are connected, not just ordinary knowledge, but systemic knowledge. So how about super alloy on this one?
Yeah, so it wasn't terribly long ago that I actually was working with one of our employees who was struggling quite a bit with actually being able to get one aspect of his work on automatic. And I'd rather not get kind of too specific about what was going on
with
this person. But at first I was telling him what I thought he should do and how he should handle it for about a week or so. And basically by the end of that week, he was back kind of off the wagon, so to speak. And so, you know, I took a step back and I was like, oh, right, that's why this isn't working, is that I was managing him rather than being a resource to him. And so I pivoted and I came back to it and I stepped in and into a bit more of a resourcing role for his growth. And he was able to get himself to a place where he was able to get that aspect of his work kind of solidly on automatic and had basically been that way ever since. So it may change, it may deviate, but I think ultimately like that was a much more clear and useful place for both of us to stand.
And we can remind people, because your story illustrates it well, the resource means to return people to themselves as the source, not to us as the source of their behavior. So, great example. Number four, when we work with the strategic corporate direction and have companies we work with do that, they work in teams. And those teams are focused on these different buyer nodes. In those teams, all of their meetings, all their thinking, use a developmental process, by which we mean use critical thinking frameworks to overcome the models that become rigid in your head. And these teams, you've heard us call them before, market field teams. So a market around each of the four or five or so buyer nodes you may have. They also act as VC engagement thinkers. Is this worth the company funding? How the budget going to work? So that as the individual puts together their own initiative, their own agency, which everyone has to do as a part of work, then they've got a really good, well-developed thinking partner in these teams. And they're thinking across the company, but particularly across the lives of a group of buyers and how they can serve them. How's that work for you at Super Allo, or does it yet?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I guess the only example I can give. So once we started hiring folks full time, I started hosting, as I've talked about before, these kind of monthly development calls for them and our regular subcontractors. And so I began introducing frameworks into subjects and topics that I could see where folks needed a way to think about something better. And this was incredibly helpful to codify things like new processes where that we needed to deploy and who our customers are and, you know, what it's actually like to be able to work together in a team and to think about kind of working together in a team. And so instead of thinking that I needed to know and do all of those things now everyone is actually actively engaged in forming that.
Great. All right. Our fifth, next to last one, is we work with something called a non-competitive hierarchy, which sounds weird, but the hierarchy is a matrix of potential ways to contribute, each of which become more deeply shifting for the marketplace. And anyone can go all the way to the top of this, or you can stay lower your whole life there, but everyone is making a promise to some specific concrete buyer that includes ecologically what they'll be doing, community-wide what they'll be doing, but it's basically the contribution to the users for this product and service organization that are coming from individuals and groups of people in a self-determined way, where they're responsible for the ideation, the creation, and the evaluation with what I call long thought promises. It takes quite a bit of work to think about it over sometimes years to pull off the promise because it's beyond what you're currently doing. But the intention and the demand is you have to understand the life of the user. You don't ask them, what do they want, agree to do it? No, you come to understand them and what they're really trying to, what they aspire to, and how you need to grow them and you over the next few years and evaluate and calibrate as you go along. And it's always inside of their value-adding process, so it's not fragmented. If you can make promises of that level, you're always demanding more of your own intelligence, your being state and ability to take on these big things, and you do become smarter at a also not just a functional way, but your own being grows and your will and your motivation and your ability to take on big things. How are you working on that Super Alloy?
Really, we've only just started this work. But I guess one thing I can say is that what's become clear is that our most rewarding work is with clients whose lives we can see ourselves clearly contributing to.
Yeah.
And where it's just, you know, work we do to pay the bills, our team is actually beginning to see how we engage with that and where it's possible to upgrade how we work so that we can get clearer and clearer on who we want to be working with rather than who we have to be working with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think that happens as you make promises and bigger ones. First, you sometimes move your clients because they weren't asking for what they needed or what was possible and you weren't offering, but you begin to see that. All right. The last of the six for today are that you create this ritual of development, which you spoke to a little bit already, but we often think of train to the task. It's like teach to the test. So we say, all right, we're getting a new information management system. We'll train everybody on it. Or we've got a new list of competencies. We'll train everybody on it. Instead, you create a developmental organization where you are monthly, like you're doing, or more often, not much less often, are introducing developmental critical thinking. and the ability to be self-managed, to be reflective, and having teams that work together be involved in that and apply it immediately. So no cold storage training, but it also is supporting all the promises beyond ableness. Because you, like you said earlier, I could see what people couldn't see, so I designed something for a call. Well, if you're ongoing doing this kind of developmental ritual, then you can be watching what people have promised to do, what they're taking on, and designed to support that indirectly as they keep working on their new promise or longer term promise. Can you speak to any of that?
Yeah. So when I have to reschedule our monthly development now, people are bummed, right? And so I think that's a pretty good sign. And so what's become clear is that this is also a massive differentiator in our industry, as kind of like, you know, it's kind of like work that often goes by the wayside. And so, you know, the thought that kind of comes to me now is like development as a competitive advantage. Who knew? You know, it's like.
So we often, we always keep copyrights on the bottom of our materials. And we did that so people would come talk to us before they did something. Not that we didn't want them to share it, but we wanted to know under what conditions help them think. But the other thing that was amazing is eventually our clients, when they noticed we didn't have a copyright or it was likely to get out, they said, wait, this is our competitive advantage. We don't want everybody who's casually having it. We assured them probably nobody would know what to do with it. To calm down a little.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And so, Carol, I guess, what do you think most organizations have to let go of in order to begin to engage in this kind of work?
Yeah, as you said earlier, it's not real easy because we have so many errors in our beliefs about how humans work, and thanks to behaviorism and 100-year history. Book number 7, out soon. No, in a year. But first, we have to let go of the idea that humans have no inner capacity for self-management, that they can't see themselves. They have no gyroscope. They have to have somebody else tell them. Secondly, that they aren't smart enough to make the decisions for themselves. And so we've been taught not to trust our own assessment and to be corrected and gain our knowledge in what's right and wrong all from outside. None of that's true. Either one of those, we have to let go of those. And then third, we have to have someone who's developed with a PhD or some kind of master's degree or incredible history that is the wise person. Now, I don't know why it is they think only a few people can get there, because my experience is everybody can get there in the kind of organization we run, but they're not taking their wisdom from outside. There are no outside specialists like managers and experts and trusted others. There's another one that may surprise people is there are a lot of problems with positivist research where you fragment something, decide you'll study this one piece and you'll create a test case, and then you come out as though you have the whole truth. What you have is, I'm not sure any truth, but you have an answer based on a fragmented study, and it's work that's being done because people believe people can't see for themselves. They can't, and the behaviorist said, don't ever ask people to report on their own thinking. They can't see it. We have to do this mechanical machines, MRI surveys, expert observation. And so we'd have to let go of all of those, or at least examine them.
Well, Carol, we're getting to the end of this episode, and I'm thoroughly depressed now. Thanks for those. I guess it's resonating for me, because it was like, this is all the stuff I was taught and managed with and parented with, and it's all kind of clearly needs to change. So I guess, why specifically do you think this is a social responsibility concern? Because that's the kind of hint that I'm getting.
Yeah. Just think about when you have a citizenry that doesn't trust itself. It believes it can't tell, it can't interpret who would be a good political appointee or elected official, or what's true, what's right and wrong, because you've been taught that other people are the ones who tell you. When you were in school, there were experts. when you were sick, you had experts. When you had mental challenges, you had experts. All of it came from outside. And when you were parented, it was mostly from outside. So if you look at what we have now, I have to fight, not just going to a website that might tell me how to vote because I'm in a hurry, because I'm so conditioned that the answer is somewhere else. And of course, if people live their whole life that way, not seeing it, they are easy fodder for the mills of people who will tell them that they can't trust this, that person, that process. Fake news runs rampant. And all that comes from us not having developed self-determining, self-assessing, like Socrates said, an unexamined life is not worth living. It also doesn't contribute to a working democracy. And I think we're in desperate need of that now. So for me, it is the new social responsibility for parents, for schools, for workplaces, and for every place we touch, where we demean people's ability to trust their own lived experience. Thank you for joining us today. We have two upcoming summits you might be interested in. One is a life partnering summit where you can work with all the concepts we're talking about with a spouse, a life partner, a business partner, where you look at how this is applied, August 12th. And if you're interested, you can, for right now, send me an email at carol@carolsanford.com, and I'll put you on a list. But hopefully, by the time this is out, we'll actually have the website ready to go. The second summit is the business summit, which happens November 15th. And it is going to be working on all the kind of things we were talking about at the end here, which is how does epistemology and the way we're working and dumbing people down threaten our ability in climate change and racial and gender and orientation equality and democracy and its working. So come join us or plan to on August 15th, and you can go to the Opportunity Business Summit webpage on carolsanfordinstitute.com and sign up for the newsletter. Or if you're on our newsletter, you'll get the notice.
Also, we have a new community for parents and couples, family pods organized around the same children, and community pods of multiple family pods that are applying the regenerative principles to familying and bringing communities of families together. You can find out more at seed-communities.com/regenerative-parent.
And we'll have that in the show notes. My last book finally fell off the bestseller list after 7 weeks. And for that, it was number one in four categories on Amazon.
Woo!
Yeah. If you would kindly, if you haven't bought one or bought them in bulk, go to carolsanford.com under books and you can learn more. There are several bonuses which are still being played out. And if you want to participate in all those or any of those, all you have to do is buy the books. And I will get you involved as soon as we can. And the worst case is with a recording. But above all, please go do a review, preferably on Amazon, but anywhere you bought the book, because that keeps spreading the word. Thank you.
This has been Business Second Opinion.